If you want to see the people and places we're talking about in the story, learn more about the investigation, including how to submit tips, or learn more about the town of Delphi, visit our website, downthehillpodcast.com.
You said the last time we spoke to you that for you, the woods will never be the same.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I still feel that way, even when I'm at home in my own woods. Yeah. I think a lot of people feel that way. There's been a lot of violation here, from the freedom and sanctity of a rural place to the perception of safety and security. I'd be willing to bet most parents in this area wouldn't drop their kids off here anymore. What a shame. What a shame.
It's a beautiful area right now.
Beautiful. This whole community is just really, just a spectacular place. Every time I come through this, you know, and this is a very trail, you know. This is the very trail, and that it's hard to get past that. It's hard to get beyond that. You know, I wish these trees could talk. You know, if these trees could talk, or stone, or whatever it might be, because they know exactly who did this.
Everything we know about what happened to Abby Williams and Libby German in those woods is a series of disconnected moments. And between each moment, a blank space. Over the past 3 years, State Police Superintendent Doug Carter, like all of us, has been trying to fill in those spaces. That's where the answers are. And now, we're about to see some of those moments for the first time.
Police are also examining this Snapchat photo. It was taken just before both girls disappeared.
I made the announcement that the girls had been found and it was not to a good end.
We are investigating this as a crime scene. We suspect foul play.
Law enforcement is saying that one of the girls actually took video on her iPhone. They say it was right before she was murdered.
It's amazing that we have a video, we have a still photograph, we have sound, and we don't know who this person is.
It could be half of the white males in Carroll County.
To the killer who may be in this room. We likely have interviewed you. We know that this is about power to you, and you want to know what we know. And one day, you will.
This is Down the Hill, the Delphi Murders.
We're back here at the CNN Center in Atlanta in our production room. I'm Barbara McDonald.
And I'm Drew Iden.
We want to thank you for coming along on this journey with us. And we're not trying to solve this case. What we want to do is make sense of it. And part of that is understanding, what do we know right now? What we know is that two girls, Abigail Williams and Liberty German, 13 and 14 years old, have been murdered. We know that they were on a bridge moments before disappearing, and that their bodies were found some distance away along a creek. And it's been described as a particularly gruesome crime scene. And that triggered a massive response from law enforcement from the get-go, including the FBI.
And coupled with that is the things that we don't know, which is there's a pretty hefty amount of that at this point. The first thing being, how were these two girls killed? The scene is gruesome. What was it that triggered such a massive law enforcement response? I mean, we're talking about multiple jurisdictions, multiple agencies, state, federal, local, everything. And then finally, we don't know the level of fear this community should have. Was this a serial killer that will strike again? Was this a one-off isolated incident, isolated crime? We don't know the level of concern that locals should have. All of that kind of funnels into the three big questions we have, which are, who did this, what the hell happened out there, and how hasn't this been solved?
And as we get back into our story, law enforcement is beginning to process the first bits of evidence, and they are still at the crime scene. They are also beginning to fan out all over the area to talk to people and to begin figuring out what happened here.
Like you said, this is the first time law enforcement is able to really wrap their hands around tangible evidence, stuff, things that will give them some insight on what in the world happened. Part 1, 2:07 p.m.
I've noticed more and more people who are walking the trails. You know, they're not walking alone. They're looking over their shoulders. They're, you know, that innocence was taken from us.
You should know the day after is an important benchmark in this case. It's where, for the first time, we see actual evidence. There are two Snapchat photos circulating. One of them shows Abby on the bridge shortly before she went missing.
And before we get to the photos, there are a couple of things about the Monon High Bridge you need to know. It's more than a century old, and it stretches more than 800 feet. And Deer Creek is 70 feet below. It hasn't been used by train since the 1980s, so the railroad ties are in pretty rough shape. There are large gaps in between. It's a tough walk. And I can tell you from experience, it is not for those with a fear of heights. In the Snapchat picture of Abby from February 13th, she's looking down, as anyone who walks this bridge does and should, and her hands appear to be in her pockets.
She's wearing blue jeans, a red t-shirt with a gray hoodie and sneakers. Her hair is in a messy bun. She's already crossed the portion of the bridge going over the creek, and the photo appears to have been taken from one of the small platforms that extend from the side of the bridge.
Here's Erica Gibson again.
Abby was happy. Like, you can't really see it. Like, she's trying to get, like, across the bridge. You know, you're a little terrified.
She's looking down at her
feet. Yeah, she's like, you can tell that they wouldn't have gone there and stuff unless they wanted to. I don't know if Abby's ever been on the bridge before, but it could have been Abby's first time. She gets a little scared sometimes, so when she probably wouldn't have walked across the bridge. So at that point, she was probably scared, but I mean, she was probably excited after she got off for herself, I'm guessing, if she's never been on it. And they were having fun. Libby was taking photos, like I said, and Abby was being a little model.
The second Snapchat photo is a black and white picture of just the bridge disappearing into the woods. There's no one in front of her, and we don't know what's happening behind her. Which of these two photos was taken first? We don't know that either. But we do know the timing here is significant.
Now, explain for me. I don't use Snapchat. Yeah. So when Libby took these two pictures, she uploaded them, which meant that, what, all of her friends or whatever her privacy setting was, all those people could see it.
Yes, everyone on her privacy settings, depending.
But then once they see it, it's supposed to disappear, is that right?
After 24 hours.
Okay. Unless you screenshot it.
Unless you screenshot it, yes.
And then you can keep it on your device.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And does it automatically have the timestamp when Libby posted that? Does it automatically, does Snapchat put that, the date and time?
I'm trying to think. It doesn't. But if I'm thinking right now, I screenshotted it when it said 3 hours. And then I looked at the time I screenshotted it was like, I don't want to get this wrong, but I forget what time, but it was like 08.
You were able to do the math and figure it out.
Yeah, it was around that. And so when I gave my phone, they're like, okay, so you took the photo at this time and it said this many hours ago. So my time stamp said like 2:10 when I think it was like 2:07. So like they're just trying to see where everybody took it to try to get approximate time that it was posted.
We talk about imagery in this case and its importance to the investigation. These two Snapchat photos are the first clues that help establish a timeline, and investigators need to get their hands on them.
The FBI came to our school, super nice people. Like, I mean, they came a few times. The office people knew them, really nice people. I've never met anybody in the FBI, and from my experience with them, they're good people. He called us in. He was like, listen, I got your name from either a last student that you may have the screenshot or that you may be able to help us. He's like, you don't have to say anything. You can walk out of here right now. But that wasn't what I'm here for. I'm not here to not give them what I know.
The FBI is continuing to interview students, and authorities are getting ready to talk to the media. It's the first press conference since yesterday's announcement that the bodies were found.
So we're back here at CNN Center, and everyone in Delphi wants to see and hear what law enforcement's going to say. You know, as we mentioned before, messaging strategy is important, especially at this period in the case. The town is looking for answers. They're looking for information. And so this is the news conference, the first one where they're going to speak with some definitive information. Let's take this thing bit by bit.
Here's Sergeant Kim Riley.
Basically, we have identified the bodies of the two females that were found out yesterday. The bodies are have been positively identified as Abigail J. Williams, 13, of the Delphi area, and Liberty Rose Lynn German, 14, of the Delphi area. The two girls were reported missing on Monday, February 13th. The bodies were discovered about 12:15 on the 14th. In the woods just east of town here by volunteers that helped in the search of the children after they were reported missing to the Carroll County Sheriff's Department. Family has been notified. This is considered a double homicide investigation. We are asking for anyone to come forward who has information that were either on the Delphi Historic Trail yet there on Monday, especially if they were near the Monon High Bridge, that they might have been seeing somebody out there. They may have taken pictures where somebody might be in that photograph. If they were out there doing that kind of stuff, we need that information. We would love to have pictures of that, more to just clarify what we got going on out there.
So they know the bridge is significant at this point, and
right.
They're asking for anybody who was out there. And we've heard that there were people out there. It was a nice day. There were people out walking, and they're asking for all those people to come forward and tell them what they know.
Is there a threat to anybody else in the community?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Is there a threat to anybody else in the community?
I'll let you answer that.
At this time, we do not believe so, sir.
Does that mean you have a person of interest in custody or a suspect?
We do not, sir.
Okay, this is a little bizarre. You have two girls found dead in the woods and a murderer who is on the loose. And understandably so, the first question from the media is, should people be afraid? And the sheriff's response is, at this time, no, sir. It's kind of a puzzling response.
You know, part of it, I think, is not wanting to alarm your community. I mean, you don't want to say, yes, everybody should panic.
Right, right, right.
But at the same time, by saying not at this time, it is sort of a, what do we do with that?
It's a little bit of damned if you do, damned if you don't, if you think about it.
It's a tough message to hear. I wonder if maybe that might be said differently today if they had a chance to do it over. But it's a fine line.
Can you tell us the cause, the manner of death that the autopsy uncovered?
No, we cannot do that at this time because of the investigation is still in its baby steps, so to speak, and we don't want to put that information out yet.
Can you describe for us the scope of the investigation, the resources, the people, what's going on with the investigation?
The Carroll County Sheriff's Department is the lead investigation. They've asked us to help. The Delphi Police Department is assisting. We have the FBI, what's called their ERT team, which is the evidence collection team that is here. And they're also providing other resources at this time. We have not put all of it together yet.
You know, we've mentioned this a bit previously, but now we know from this news conference that the FBI is involved. And Sergeant Kim Riley says in that news conference, it's the evidence response team and other resources.
Right.
So obviously leads to the question is, what are those other resources? What's the scope of the FBI's involvement? Because they don't get involved in every murder.
No, they
double
don't.
Homicide case.
Right. This is also where I think it sort of begins that cops in this kind of get a reputation for being tight-lipped. They're not revealing a lot of information. They can't at this point. And that's something that's going to be sort of a theme throughout this investigation.
So we got a lot of new information out of that news conference, but as we're about to find out, they are not quite done for the day.
Two, a blurry picture and barren woods.
Well, and I think, you know, as more of the story came out and, you know, they kind of learned where the picture came from, I don't think you would find a classmate to say a bad word about Abby or Liberty. They were just great kids. Liberty just wanted the world to be kind, and Abby wanted everyone in the world to have things, like have a gift at Christmas.
We are following breaking news tonight out of Indiana. Someone has murdered two girls, one just 13 years old, the other 14. And in their search for information, they are trying to locate anyone who was in the wooded area at the time, including a male subject seen on these photographs. They were just released minutes ago by the Indiana State Police. They say they would like to ask this person what he might have seen.
That's Jean Casares. She's anchoring on HLN that night, talking through what happened that day with her guests when the photos are released. The two photos in question are blurry. They show a man walking on that same bridge around the same time as the girls. The Indiana State Police said the photos, quote, appear to depict a white male wearing blue jeans, a blue coat slash jacket, and a hoodie. Those are the broad strokes of the person in these photos. Beyond that, you see a man with his hands in his pockets, walking on the bridge, looking down. He's framed by the kind of woods you see in winter, bare branches, dead trees. That was just one of the many things to talk about that night.
Christine Grillo, there was a press conference today, and this is a small community. They're not used to this. They have called in the FBI to help with the recovery. They are still processing the crime scene as we speak tonight. They haven't said if they've recovered the cell phones. How important is that?
I think the cell phones are going to be very important.
It's not too long before we learn that is an understatement.
As you see, the Snapchat photo that you put up there is a very telling photo. It gives probably the last person perhaps that saw them alive. The cell phones are going to give a lot of information. They're also not releasing certain information, and they're probably taking this investigation very slowly and very carefully. They're not releasing how the girls died, perhaps because they want to investigate further before saying something, before tipping someone off. So the cell phones are going to be very, very important. The information and the communication that might have been picked up on those cell phones right before their death.
Christine Grillo is sitting in a New York TV studio, and she couldn't know this yet, but she was absolutely right about that. Immediately after this picture was released, everyone not involved in the investigation, including TV legal analysts, were asking the same questions and are starting to draw some early conclusions.
Let's look at this picture again that was just released of someone they say was walking along the trail, the Delphi Trail. This is the Monnenhai Bridge, possibly was a known place. First of all, I am shocked that there was a camera.
Yeah, I want to know where that picture came from. And the thing about it that we're talking about, Gene, is this is broad daylight. This is 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Yeah. And it's a small town and a small community. And the benefits of living in the small town with a small community is someone there has to know who that person is.
Yeah.
Or if the person is not from there, we'll be able to see, did anyone see him? Did you see someone suspicious? Were there any cars? Are there cameras in the parking lot of the trail? You hope if it's a state or a government property that they have some semblance of surveillance that tracks who comes in and who goes out. And again, to piece the puzzle together.
And Christine, the bodies of these two young girls were not found actually on the trail. They were found off the trail, actually on private property, but close to a shoreline. So cars couldn't get anywhere near where those bodies were found.
So it could be that, you know, you're doing that so you're hoping no one does find them, that there's more decomposition to the bodies, less evidence found. You know, you don't know what these murderers are thinking.
Christine, when you look at the crime scene and they are continuing to process and the amount of evidence, here's the cold, hard fact. One of those two young girls most likely witnessed
the murder of the second.
Of her friend.
Yes. They're going to be able to find out a lot of information, and you hope that there's going to be discretion attached to all of this, that if that information is not going to lead them to a conviction of the murderer of these two girls, that is something that maybe they won't share, and it won't be, they won't say that it's clearly determined, because that is a horrible thought. It really is. And, you know, they should be afraid. You're right. There is a killer on the loose. These are two young girls doing something that young girls do, and somebody found them and killed them.
As the picture makes headlines and sparks more questions, the family is straddling two different emotions. Loss and optimism that the picture will start filling in some blanks. Here's how Libby's grandfather, Mike Patty, sitting with his wife, Becky, remembers it.
We're just sitting here, both of us, in such disbelief that this has happened. So I don't know when they shared that information with us, if it was before, or if they just released that information out, which was the picture of the, we all refer to him now as Bridge Guy. I do recall, seems like it was a person of interest that we want to talk to.
For Carrie Timmons, Libby's mom, it was just one more thing.
So there was suddenly all this speculation of, is there a trail cam? Is there... You know, I think that was probably the biggest one. There had to have been a trail cam out there, and so it's all caught on video. And then there are people, where is this trail cam? And I'm just like, we didn't know immediately that it had come from her phone. But then I think they released within a few days after that it had come from her phone. But then all the rumors started of, well, do they have her phone? Did they get it from iCloud? Where did this come from? So that just, it was all really crazy. And everything kind of happened pretty quickly. I mean, we were suddenly like planning a funeral and planning a viewing. And it just grew. Like it was so big.
So when you look at the chronology of the story from February 2017 to where we are now, it is littered with big moments. And this is the biggest one to date. The picture is from video on her phone. And it's interesting because, you know, we know now that it's from video, but at the time, families, the media, people watching, like, we didn't know that.
Right. They didn't say where it had come from. And people were wondering, like, was there a trail cam out there? Is there a surveillance camera? And then we find out it's from Libby's phone, and she's called a hero for that. I remember when that photo came out, and they're saying, this is just somebody we want to talk to.
Right.
And I remember being skeptical immediately that, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Is he just somebody you want to talk to, or is he a little more than that?
I remember working for HLN at the time and being in the control room while we were covering this case. And I turned to the producer to my left and I said, look, police aren't calling this guy a suspect, but we all kind of know where this road is headed.
And this is also where we learn a nickname for him, because he is unnamed. So people start calling him Bridge Guy, which is sort of morphed into BG, the initials.
It's also where there begins laser focus on the bridge. The dimensions, the geography, which direction the guy was coming from, where on the bridge that photo was taken. There is just a hyper focus and fascination and interest on the bridge itself.
There's a lot to dissect about that photo, too. What does it actually show us? Are his hands in his pockets? Are his hands in his jacket? What's he wearing exactly? Does he have something on his head? Is that a shirt tail?
If the walls of this writer's room could talk about the things we've speculated in that photo, at least 55 different things. What they are, what they aren't, what they could be, what they can't be. I mean, the speculation and the guessing of what's in that photo is literally endless.
And you would think when you hear that there's a photo of somebody that you would be able to tell what they're wearing, what they look like. And in this photo, you just can't. And if you want to see these pictures, you can go to our website, which is downthehillpodcast.com. And we've got all of the materials there so you can see everything yourself.
There's a lot to look at in this story. So it's a great spot to find all of the visual elements, maps, photos, you know, all of that stuff.
When the photo was released, everyone believed that someone must, has to, recognize this person. That was the early feeling. Since then, that picture's been pored over, it's been analyzed, and it's been picked apart by anyone and everyone with an interest in this case, especially investigators. Here's ISP Superintendent Doug Carter.
So all I'll say is we've had a lot of work done with the photograph.
And you can't make that better for the public?
No.
Can I ask, when you look at that, do you see a hat? Do you see hair? Do you see a hood? Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I do. And again, I'm not, a long time ago, I don't look at the head anymore. I look at everything else we know about this person, not what we think. What do we know about this person? We know what his body looks like. We know how he walks. We know how he talks.
While the people of Delphi wrap their heads around the photo of the man on the bridge, there's a wave of media on the way.
Hey everyone, it's Dan. Over the last two chapters, we've taken a little time out to find some moments that give us a sense of who Abby and Libby were. And this time, we're going to hear from Cynthia Rossi. You've met her before earlier in our story. She and Abby were very close friends. So here's Cynthia with a memory of summer times and Abby.
We would always spend our summers by her pool. And we just loved eating watermelon while sitting on her porch under an umbrella by the pool. And we would always take our watermelon slices and set them out on the railing of her porch and wait for all the butterflies to come. And she loved watching the butterflies. She has always loved butterflies. They were just such a huge part of her life, such a huge symbol in her life. And I'll just never forget us sitting there for way too much time, just staring at butterflies. I just remember whenever we spent our summers together, we just felt free from school and responsibility. And we just felt like we could spend quality time together and we wouldn't have to worry about homework or any assignments. And I think she just liked the fact that they were free and they just flew wherever they wanted. They could do whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted. And I think she just liked that about them.
We'll have more memories of Abby, Libby, and the people of Delphi in upcoming chapters. For now, though, let's get back to the show.
Part 3, A Little Beehive.
Nobody smiled. I mean, nobody smiled for days. It was just this, it gives me goosebumps still to think about it. It was sad. It was a very slow pace. It wasn't that people were suspicious of others. I think that came later. It was just this air of, oh, I don't even want to be here. You know, I don't know what to do with myself. And we were flooded, you know, with media. And so if anything, you saw a lot of media trucks and people interviewing and people just stopping and wanting to say, hey, do you want to say a few words on camera? And, you know, locals just, we were all still trying to process what in the world had happened.
Barb, why do you think this story has stuck out?
I think there's a couple of different elements. It's a small town that's considered a safe place, and then something really terrible happened there in broad daylight, and then it only got more bizarre from there.
Right. I mean, if this happened up the road in Chicago or in Indianapolis, it wouldn't necessarily be the lead on every single news channel. And I think the other thing is, you know, the media in a town like this, the story that they were coming to cover, it wasn't necessarily the story they were going to get or that they're going to get because of the twists and turns that continue to take place.
Exactly. It's a bizarre story. We generally know how these things are going to end. And in this one, nobody could have anticipated where we are today. And a lot of that at this point is falling on the shoulders of one man, and that's Sergeant Kim Riley from the Indiana State Police. When did this really start, this case start to really get the media attention outside of this area?
I'm going to say late that night or early the next morning, because we started to get, believe it or not, we had the BBC showed up out of New York. I had a couple of other reporters were here. I was getting phone calls from other countries. It was just starting to snowball. I mean, I've dealt with national news on other things, but not to the way this was. And it was just a whole new experience for me. And it was time to call in some help for me. And I had some great other PIOs. They came in and assisted me and backed me up. Where I would do one thing, they would be doing something else behind the scenes. So it was nice to know that I had that kind of help. For the first month or so, it just continued. And the interest just kept growing and growing.
Why do you think there's that interest?
I think once we kind of got out of what happened and the information that we did put out there, it just, I know at first we didn't put a whole lot, and there was reasons. You know, you don't throw your three aces on the ground when you're looking for the fourth one in a card game. And that's, you know, that's kind of what we were trying to do, is hold all the information in we could, but yet still feed the media as much as we could. And I know there's a fine line between those two, and there was a couple times that I probably said something I should have not have said, but it was one of those things that it was hard to hold it back. And I always conferred with my lead detectives, both in the sheriff's department and our guys and with the FBI, when we did do news conferences or when they knew I was getting this information and was getting ready to put it out. I always ran it by them before, most of the time before. There was times I could not do that, but 90% of the time I tried to run everything by them before I talked to the media, because I didn't want to say something that was going to, you know, jeopardize or hurt the investigation. So it was a fine line on what we were doing, but we tried to do the best we could with the information we could put out there.
While Kim Riley is managing the onslaught of media, the appeal for tips and leads at yesterday's press conference is clearly being answered. Hundreds of them have already come in. And while that's happening, Sheriff Tobe Lesenby is managing his team of investigators in a community dealing with a sudden influx of, well, everyone.
It's just that sudden swarming, if you will, that occurred in our community where, you know, whether it was law enforcement, media, you know, the governor himself, you know, coming on board, just the initial overwhelming feeling. You know, I'll never forget, you know, where we currently are down at the Delphi City building. It was kind of like watching a little beehive. I mean, with all these investigators in and out the door all the time with a file in their hand and going to follow into whomever, you know, I remember seeing that first couple of days around, you know, once we were organized around the clock. I mean, there were many a nights I was up there till, you know, maybe 1 or 2 in the morning and still seeing guys in and out the door all the time following into things.
Those things they were following up on would lead them to a property on the southwest side of Carroll County. Here's HLN anchor Gene Casares again with Lindsay Eaton She's a reporter based out of Indianapolis.
We do have information to report the state police are serving a search warrant at a home in Delphi. Now, this is in response to information that police received through tips and through interviews giving probable cause to search the home. No word on whether there have been any arrests at this hour. We do want to begin tonight with Lindsay Eaton. She is a reporter for CBS 4, Fox 59 in Indianapolis. Lindsay, you are at the scene tonight. Tell us what you have seen with executing of this search warrant at a home.
Correct. We've been out here for about an hour. State police did serve a search warrant at this home. Within the past hour, some of the authorities have left. There is still quite a large presence of authorities out here. We have seen detectives bringing out some boxes from this home. There's a field next door to this home. We saw detectives with flashlights looking through the field. At this point, the latest we have heard, no arrests have been made. And troopers, or Sergeant Riley actually just told us about an hour ago that they don't anticipate any arrests to be made, that this was part of following up on a tip that they received. And he said this is just another piece of the puzzle. They're following up on each and every tip.
Lindsay, I want some more detail here. How many boxes have you seen authorities take out tonight? Have they taken anything other than boxes? Any carpeting, any mattresses, anything?
We have not. We saw maybe just a couple. Like I said, we got here around 7 o'clock. We saw maybe a couple boxes taken from the home. I can tell you there was no crime tape around the house. There are a few authorities still out here. They were searching the field next door. We saw them going around the house, up in and out of the front door. And that's about it at this point.
Minutes later, on the same show, Kim Riley called in from the scene of that search.
Okay, so you went to a judge and a judge signed off on this warrant. Why did you select this home in Delphi?
Through the investigation with the tips and the interviews we've had, we had probable cause to go into the house and do a search on it.
When you look at the timeline of this case, there are multiple blips on that timeline of really significant events. On February 16th, at dusk, the search of this home outside of town, which we just heard Kim Riley talking about.
Yeah.
I'm trying to imagine what it was like to be a Delphi resident and hear that there is a swarm of law enforcement on a home.
You must think that this is it. We're going to get this solved, that this is the end of it. And that's not what happened. They were there for several hours. We saw boxes coming out. The media had gathered. I mean, it was a big spectacle on the edge of town.
You know, this is 2 days after the murders. And I'm sure there had to be some feeling amongst the folks in town because, as we've mentioned, this is a small town. So law enforcement activity of that scale on a house outside of town within an hour, everyone in town knows that this is happening. There has to be a feeling of optimism and hope that there is going to be some new information, new answers. The most optimistic being we're going to wrap this thing up and figure it out.
Right. That's what it looks like. This is the first big police response we're seeing other than them out at the scene. And I'm sure a lot of people did feel that way. But that's not what happened. And instead, the prosecutor, Robert Ives, takes to his Facebook page that night. And this is what he wrote, according to the Lafayette Journal and Courier. And he wrote, "Please do not harass, bother, or accuse anyone. There are no charges pending against anyone as a result of the pending investigation. No one at the home search is suspected of committing any crime. Please, please leave these people alone and let the police work." And at the time that the newspaper quoted that Facebook post, they said it had already been shared like 600 times.
Right.
So you have this huge response, but then you have this message from the officials that nothing came of that.
But it still leaves a question because we heard Kim Riley say just a moment ago, he said, "We had probable cause to go into the house and do a search on it." In order to get a search warrant, you have to have probable cause. So what's the probable cause? We don't know. So who knows about probable cause? Attorneys. Right. So we have one. Brett Semitovich, if the last name sounds familiar, it is also the last name of our producer, Dan Semitovich.
They are brothers.
Brett, thanks for joining us. He's been on the phone many a days, many a times for us as we've kind of picked his legal brain. How are you today, man?
I'm doing well. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We call Brett all the time when we have questions.
Right.
This is just the first time we're doing it with microphones.
Right, because we've talked a lot about the legal side of this case. You know, obviously there's a lot of kind of criminal investigation stuff, but, at some point we're going to hit some sort of legal phase. So we've talked to Brett a lot about this. But, Brett, I'm curious, can you kind of give us some understanding of what a search warrant entails? Like, what is probable cause? Kind of give it to us in layman's terms for the people that don't deal with this every day.
Sure. Well, in layman's terms, probable cause means that the police have a reasonable belief that there is evidence of a crime in a place to be searched. That's boiling away down, of course. But ultimately, in order to get a search warrant, as a former prosecutor, I can tell you just from my own experiences, what would happen is that a police officer or detective would come into our office. They would have an affidavit that would be a sworn statement in support of not only their experience, but also why they believe that this property needs to be searched and what they're looking for. And if it met that probable cause standard, that there is a good faith basis to believe that there is evidence of the crime on this property or place to be searched, then that would go to the judge. The judge would review it for accuracy, sufficiency, and if there is enough probable cause, the judge would sign off on that search warrant, and then it's off to the races for the police.
Now, how specific do they need to be in that statement? Do they need to say we're looking for a gun or we're looking for bloody clothes? Do they need to be that specific?
They should be as specific as they possibly can, because a search warrant needs to be limited in scope. And by that, I mean you can't say I'm going to search the entire state of Indiana, right? You have to say I'm searching this house, this property for this reason, and here's what I'm looking for. But most importantly, why am I looking for it there? You can't just say, I picked this random house, I want to search it. It has to be supported by competent evidence. And by that, I mean this. The police have to say, well, we have a tip from someone. We saw a bloody shoe from across the way, and there it is. We want to go in and get it, right? There has to be more than just a wild goose chase. It has to be supported by competent evidence. And if you don't have that, you're not going to have probable cause to grant that search.
And what is your experience with how high this bar is for judges when they're looking at these statements? Is it a really high bar? They have to prove that they have reason to believe this evidence exists there? Or is it a low bar because this is just a search warrant?
Well, it's a high burden that's placed on the judges and on the police, I should say. And it should be, because you're trying to have the police enter your private property to search for something. It's a relatively high burden. That being said, there's no defendant that's arguing against why the police should not be able to go in there. The person who's the subject of the search doesn't have the ability to contest the search warrant at the outset. So it's a one-sided game in that regards. But you still have to have enough to reach that probable cause threshold.
So, Brett, you're saying that there's generally a high bar that has to be cleared in terms of probable cause. There has to be a narrow scope of what you're looking for. This search specifically on this property, 2 days after these girls are murdered, is it unusual to you that a search like this ended with nothing this soon after the crime?
Yes. Generally speaking, of course, in my experience, if you're getting a search warrant that is really close to the crime, then usually, or should be, supported by competent evidence, there's a reason that you're looking so quickly and feel like it's necessary to get a search warrant within a couple days for that property. The information, in theory, of the crime is still fresh, right? All that's happening really quickly. If you're getting a search warrant maybe a couple of years after a crime occurred and you're trying to go back and piece things together, well, no, it's a little bit more common that you're going to strike out, for lack of a better term. But when it's so close in time to the crime, I think it is surprising and usually pretty rare that you're just going to come up empty-handed.
That's interesting.
Real interesting. Brett Semitovich, thanks for joining us, man. We really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So, Barb, I know that Robert Ives, the prosecutor in Delphi and Carroll County at the time, said, as you mentioned, no one at the home searched is suspected of committing any crime. That doesn't mean that law enforcement can't then revisit later.
Right. But it's been 3 years. We've had recent conversations with Kim Riley from the Indiana State Police. And he says that that search is not as significant to the investigation now as it seemed that night to them. And that they went to that property. They thought there could be somebody at that property who was a suspect. And apparently, the investigation revealed that wasn't the case.
And he also told us it's not as important of an asset as it was that night. So the property and that search warrant, it would appear as it stands now, they've moved on. But for the people of Delphi, for a property to be searched and combed over and picked through with the vigor that this police force was using, had to have been some optimism.
Thinking that they're going to be making an arrest. But this is also part of what they're doing, is they're also trying to figure out where their attention is not needed. They're looking at people, they're looking at evidence, they're looking at all the different things that are coming their way and figuring out what matters to this investigation and what doesn't. And it certainly looks like right now that search is not a big part of this investigation.
And it should also be mentioned, you know, we tried to get the paperwork related to that search warrant. But as the ISP or any law enforcement agency will do in an ongoing investigation, that is their justification for denying the request for the documents.
So it's an ongoing investigation, so it's sealed.
Did do our due diligence, but unfortunately they were not able to release. And also because ruling out in a lot of ways is just as important as ruling in.
In our next chapter,
I have trouble saying those words. I hate to hear it. Anybody really remembers, but that very first time that that recording was played, he couldn't really understand what he was saying. And it was all like computerized sounding. And then they were able to clean it up. And suddenly it was DTH. And it was like, what the hell is he saying? Like, why? And I remember thinking that it doesn't even sound like urgent. He's not yelling. He's so calm.
Down the Hill is written and produced by Dan Semitovich, Andrew Iden, and me, Barbara McDonald, with original music and scoring by Shuvo Sur. Michael Dudley and Kayleen Chassie are associate producers. If you want to see the people, places, and things we're talking about, visit our website, downthehillpodcast.com. Sherry Seldes is HLN's Senior Production Manager. Brian Bell is HLN's Senior Director of Programming. And Tyler Moody is the Vice President of the Warner Media Podcast Network. A special thanks to the people of Delphi and the members of law enforcement who are in charge of solving this crime. And most important of all, a big thank you to you, of course. We appreciate you listening.